We are now prepared to hear the third case on oral argument today, People of the State of Colorado versus Tiendin Pham. Have counsel received the instructions as to how to proceed with oral argument? I would also ask everybody in the courtroom that has a cell phone or other communication device to please turn it off so that people are not interrupted. And before we proceed, I want to welcome Ms. Martin's eighth grade class, which has now joined us. I understand they're on a civics lesson today, and they're going to see part of the state government in action. So we're welcome to have you. You're very welcome, and we're glad to have you here. Council, please proceed.
Good day. May it please the court, council. We're before the court today on an appeal from Mr. Pham's second 35C motion. This was a motion which admittedly was filed outside the three-year period of limitations and was dismissed by the district court without a hearing, in large part relying upon the assertion of untimeliness. And so one of the central issues before the court today relates to whether or not Mr. Pham, in his 35C motion, made a sufficient showing of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect for submitting his 35C motion outside the three-year period of limitations.
Isn't there also a question of he having to justify this as a successive motion?
Your Honor, I believe not across the board, certainly not with regard to all of the issues that he's raised, in particular with the Brady issue that he's raised, Your Honor.
Well, we've all got copies of the motion. Anywhere in there does he say that he could not have discovered this eyewitness through the exercise of reasonable diligence?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe he phrased it in exactly those words, but I believe a fair reading of the 35C motion makes that apparent from its face. He talks about how he discovered this information in February of 2007, and that in the course of discovering of this witness coming forward, he learned that that witness had not been disclosed in the underlying trial proceedings. And
sorry to interrupt, he talks about how this witness was discovered, because that's what I was looking at, count six on his motion. He just said it was discovered.
This is
yeah,
true.
I was thinking perhaps this discovery was already in the discovery originally provided and he never read it over carefully. I mean, there's all kinds of things that could infer how this was discovered.
Yes, Your Honor, although he does disclose that this newly discovered witness, Mr. Tsuchaya, was not listed as a witness anywhere in any of the trial materials, never designated as a witness, never identified as a witness.
Okay, but he doesn't say in the motion how he discovered Mr. Tsuchaya, correct?
That is correct.
And he doesn't say that he could not have discovered Mr. Tsuchaya in the exercise of reasonable diligence, correct?
He does not say it in those words, Your Honor, but I believe that message is clearly conveyed in the motion.
Why is it incumbent on him to say so?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's incumbent upon him to use any particular phrasing in conveying that message. I believe what's significant and determinative is that he convey the message that this was not a witness who was discoverable in the ordinary course. And I believe, frankly, inherent in the very nature of a 35C motion that's alleging a Brady violation, as his does, is the fact that this was not a witness who was readily identifiable or discoverable in the ordinary course.
Whose case was tried first, his or the shooter's?
Your Honor, I believe it was the shooter, but I don't have a clear recollection.
Do you know if Mr. Tsuchaya testified in the shooter's case?
I am, again, Your Honor, I'm going from recollection, but I am fairly certain he did not testify in the shooter's case.
And you're not going to enlighten us as to how Mr. Pham did discover Mr. Shia's identity in February of 2007?
Your Honor, I'm happy to do that. It's just simply not reflected in the record. But the way that Mr. Pham learned of this witness's existence was by being approached by this individual while he was incarcerated. They are both, in fact, in custody at Sterling. And Mr. Tsuchaya simply approached Mr. Pham one day and initiated a conversation saying, in essence, wow, surprised to see you here. I saw the whole thing happen. That was how it was, how Mr. Tsuchaya came to Mr. Pham's attention.
Why isn't that in the record?
Your Honor, I believe, again, that the specific mechanism is not particularly vital or fatal to Mr. Pham's 35C motion.
I was reading the factual background in the motion itself. It says, on February 1st, 2007, Mr. Pham learned that an eyewitness at the cafe gave Denver police detectives a written statement following the shooting. So there is a written statement apparently somewhere. And I was, as I indicated before, that could have been given over in discovery, and he just going through it and saw this and thought, well, why wasn't this brought out in trial? That certainly could have been discovered earlier and was in his possession. That's the justifiable excusable neglect piece of this that, to me, is missing.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Pham learned that Mr. Tsuchaya gave this written statement by Mr. Tsuchaya relating that fact to
him. But that's not indicated anywhere in the record, is what you're telling me.
Your Honor, it's not overtly stated in the record, but again, I believe what we're kind of circling around here is whether or not Mr. Pham was obligated to present evidence of these facts to the court, or simply assert facts which, if true, would have permitted him to have an evidentiary hearing on these issues. And my contention,
assuming I think you're correct that that's the standard, he didn't assert a critical fact. I could not have discovered Mr. Tsuchaya in the exercise of reasonable diligence. And I agree, you know, had he said that, he'd been given a chance to prove it, but he didn't say it.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. I believe that the overwhelming substance of his motion conveys exactly that message, perhaps not using verbiage that would have made it precisely clear, but what Mr. Pham did raise in his 35C motion was a very clear Brady violation. And inherent in the notion of a Brady violation is that information was withheld and not otherwise discoverable. I mean, there's really no other way to assert a Brady violation.
Okay, but even under Brady, in imposing sanctions, courts look at whether the withheld information was otherwise accessible to the defense in the exercise of reasonable diligence, don't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So the fact that he raises a Brady violation is not a way of saying, and I couldn't have found out this in reasonable diligence.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that, although I don't dispute that that is the guiding standard under Brady, a person in Mr. Pham's position would not, be asserting a Brady violation if that were true. In essence, it's implicit any time a party brings and asserts a Brady violation, he's asserting that this information was withheld and not otherwise discoverable.
This wasn't a pro se motion, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is the Brady standard similar to a justifiable excuse standard?
I don't.
You've conceded that it's outside the three-year limitations.
Yes, Your Honor. This motion clearly is outside the three-year limitations period. But I believe, you know, the really the genesis of making exceptions to that three-year time period finds its origin in Brady and these types of violations that are not discoverable through no wrongdoing or inaction or ineptitude on the part of the moving party. And I believe here, where Mr. Pham has clearly raised and asserted the Brady violation, which is classic Brady in that it is material and exculpatory evidence, to simply say, well, you know, Mr. Pham didn't use the right words in his motion when in fact he's laid out in detail the Brady violation that he asserts, I think really is elevating form above substance in a distressing manner.
Does the requirement of 35C37B for successive motions, that the successive motion fails unless there's a showing as to why those issues couldn't have been raised in the prior motion, heighten the pleading standard? In other words, since he's admittedly making a second motion, why isn't he affirmatively required to allege the magic words in 35C37B?
Your Honor, I believe that in this situation, where Mr. Pham details when he first became aware of this evidence, alleges that the discovery of this evidence implicates Brady by detailing how the information was not disclosed to him and was not and was essentially withheld by the state, that takes him outside the prohibition of successor 35C motions. I believe that it's inherent in having raised a Brady violation and in setting out the timeline of when he first discovered this information, Your Honor.
What is the basis for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim? Does he have reason to believe that his counsel did have the statement in his files?
At the reason for that claim, Your Honor, at the trial level, there are two ineffective assistance claims that are raised, one at the appellate and one at the trial level. At the trial level, it's raised as an alternative claim, that if, in fact, this were not a Brady violation, then it must be ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Pham believes that this is clearly a Brady violation. He asserts this simply as a fallback argument that if, for some reason, it's not Brady, then it must be ineffective assistance. If it was, in fact, discoverable, then his counsel was ineffective and not discovering.
Did he obtain his trial counsel's files and search through there to see if there is a copy of the statement from Mr. Tsuchaya?
Your Honor, I was not involved in the course of the preparation of the 35C motion itself, but I do know that all of those underlying files were taken in and reviewed by counsel in the preparation of the 35C motion that's at issue here today.
What is his ineffective assistance claim against appellate counsel?
The ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim goes to primarily the fact that appellate counsel did not file a writ of certiorari with the state Supreme Court and did not advise him of the ramifications in terms of foreclosing federal mandamus action as a result of that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have one. Does the exhaustion doctrine still apply? Because certiorari review is now, I mean, didn't the rule change several years ago that said that you do not need to apply for certiorari review to exhaust your remedies?
Your Honor, that, honestly, I am not prepared to speak to that point.
Okay.
If there's nothing further, I'll reserve my minute.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. Judge Furman, I'll answer your question real fast because it's right on my mind. Yes, Rule 51-1 says you no longer have to file for cert review to exhaust your claims for federal habeas purposes. And they have been applying that from my experience. So, also, we have case law saying that appellate counsel doesn't provide ineffective assistance by failing to advise a defendant of the availability of federal review and post-conviction review. Here, the defendant did not assert sufficient facts to overcome the time bar. He didn't explain why he didn't learn of this statement later, who this person was, what difference was it, would it have made, what the circumstances were surrounding this statement. So I think the trial court properly denied his motion for failure to establish justifiable excuse or excusable neglect.
Well, you said he didn't assert what difference it would have made. Isn't the Mr. Sirchaya's statement clearly exculpatory from a self-defense standpoint if he is to be believed that the people in the restaurant started shooting first?
Well, I think if we step back and we first just look at the issue of the justifiable excuse and excusable neglect alone and ignore the underlying claim for a second, especially in a case like this one where you're asserting both that the prosecution withheld it and that, well, maybe the prosecution didn't withhold it, but that means my trial counsel was ineffective. You need to explain how you came about this statement. You need to provide more information about the statement itself to show justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. Why I couldn't get this statement sooner, why this wasn't available to me sooner, since he is saying both things. Because the second thing, of course, implies his counsel did, in fact, have the statement. But then when you go down and you look at the underlying claims, for example, seeking a new trial based on newly discovered evidence is what he's claiming. Generally, with that claim, you have to make allegations that are sufficient to show that it would have made a difference in the case, that this newly discovered evidence is how he frames it.
He was not the shooter. He was in a...
Correct.
And the shooter, what was the disposition of the shooter's case?
I don't recall, Your Honor.
Well, the motion alleges the shooter pled self-defense and was acquitted of the primary charges. Do you have any reason to dispute that?
I have no reason to dispute it, but I'm not familiar with the co-defendant's case at all. In my reading of the evidence in this case was that the defendant was the driver, and he and a lot of this was captured on videotape. The defendant and the driver pull up next to this cafe, leave the doors open, walk in, and the co-defendant starts shooting. There was no evidence, as I recall, that the defendant started shooting. And there were numerous witnesses in this cafe that said that they shot first. There was a witness who said that someone in the cafe began shooting first. So there was some of this evidence presented.
And that was at trial?
Yes. Yes, at this defendant's trial.
So Mr. Sirchaya's statement would be duplicative of evidence already heard by the jury as to who started shooting first?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, what I remember from reading in this case is that the bulk of the physical evidence and the videotape, and we had a bunch of eyewitnesses, went to the fact that a person in the cafe didn't start firing until after the co-defendant started firing, and then they ran out. That's with the ballistics evidence and that kind of thing tied in with what most of the eyewitnesses were saying, which is they just walked in and co-defendant started firing.
Counsel, in paragraph 29 of his motion, Mr. Fenn alleged that these material facts were not heretofore presented or heard. I guess it could not be discovered by the exercise of reasonable diligence, could not have been known. Doesn't that satisfy the standard at least to have a hearing on whether or not they could have been discovered?
I think you have to then go, if you have some hint of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect, you could then flip over and start looking at the substantive claims themselves, what he's bringing, And those all fail as a matter of law because there are insufficient allegations to support them, and a lot of them are contradicted by the record. So even if you look at his reason for why he filed this late, so even if you accept that's an okay reason, you look at the substantive claims, and they fail. The allegations are simply insufficient, or they're contradicted by the record.
But the trial court did not make those findings. It didn't go that far. It simply dismissed the Rule 35 on the grounds that it wasn't timely filed.
As I recall, the trial court did make some mention of something being conclusory and insufficient facts as to a couple of the claims, at least one of the claims.
It just says counts 3, 4, and 5 are either based on speculation and without facts or untimely filed. There's no comment about claims 1 and 2 of the substance in the court's order. Is the standard such that there could be a two-level process here, that he just has to allege I could not have discovered it with reasonable diligence, and then there has to be a second level where the court has a hearing and makes a finding as to whether or not he would have discovered it with reasonable diligence?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's his burden to establish sufficient facts in his motion to show that he's overcome the time bar. And there's plenty of case law standing for that. If it was enough just to allege it, then the rule would be meaningless. The trial courts would have to have a hearing anytime somebody made that allegation in a post-conviction motion, regardless of how meritless the underlying claims were or regardless of what else was going on. So I think we require a little bit more than that.
Well, a little bit more might include I didn't discover it till February 7th. And if he'd gone one step further and said I didn't discover it till February 7th because that's when Mr. Tsuchiya came to me in prison and told me about it, we wouldn't be here today, would we? Or at least you wouldn't be arguing this.
I don't know. I don't know what the trial court would have done with the claims under that circumstance. I think you just have to have more facts than he had here to establish justifiable excuse or excusable neglect, especially given the fact that some of his allegations were, they contradicted one another. Because there are lots of things somebody could assert that would be outside the record that I think we'd all agree wouldn't entitle them to an evidentiary hearing. He had said President Bush told him this, this, and that, and I thought, I mean, none of us would say, oh, that, you know, this is a fact outside the record, we have to have a hearing because you've made this allegation, and if this allegation is true, this, 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 then follow. I think you have an obligation to establish sufficient facts to show that there is a good reason, and he just didn't do it here.
What, I mean, realistically, what facts could he allege as to why he couldn't discover this person with reasonable diligence? I mean, apparently the facts were that he was in the restaurant for a matter of seconds before somebody started shooting. I mean, would he have to say that my attorney interviewed everybody that I recognized in the restaurant and none of them named Mr. Tsuchiya, even though my attorney asked everybody to name all the people that were present? I mean, what could he really say that would meet your test?
That would meet this test?
Yeah.
Well, in this motion, I think, and he didn't do it, is say, here's how I learned of this statement.
Well, that doesn't answer the question of why he couldn't have learned about it 5 years ago.
Right.
Okay, so what would you expect him, just be specific, what should he have put in the motion to satisfy your definition of reasonable diligence?
Here's how I learned of the statement. I learned of the statement on such and such a date.
That's already in there.
This person told me, well, not in the original motion, he left out details. He did, as I believe he filed a motion for reconsideration where he attached more information, but about it. Here's how I came to learn of the statements. Here, he could have taken steps to determine if in fact his attorney was aware of the statement, if in fact it was part of the discovery. He could have taken those kinds of steps and said this. So then we've got the justifiable excuse and excusable neglect fairly fleshed out. And then you have to then look at the claim itself. And here's why it would have made a difference in my case, because part of this is I think I'm entitled to post-conviction relief. I need to establish justifiable excuse, and I need to show an entitlement to post-conviction relief as well on the claim that I want to present. So you have to present the factors that are relevant to that claim, which in this case would have been why it would have made a difference in this case.
Okay, and I apologize, but I'm seeing quarrels. I mean, you're really not answering my question. I mean, the motion says when he learned of Mr. Shishai. It's got an exact date. It says Mr. Shishai's statement would have been exculpatory. What else would he have to allege to meet your standard of why he could not have come to that knowledge early? And the motion also says the police withheld this information. So please be specific. What exactly would he have to say to explain why he couldn't have justified it earlier, found the witness earlier, beyond what he's already got in there?
I think he has to present facts showing that he attempted to locate all the witnesses. I think he could present facts showing that he got the discovery, the information from the police department that was in there, that was never disclosed. That he could allege those kinds of facts establishing that these things occur. He's just saying this person was in discovery or wasn't in discovery, and I think he needs to allege facts showing that whether or not that witness was there, was listed as a witness, whether or not the because this is all information he can get. This is all documents he can get from his trial attorney or from the police department or in the court record.
Well, he says in paragraph 18, the exculpatory information comes from a witness whose statement was never disclosed to the defense. Isn't that necessarily saying it wasn't produced in discovery?
Well, then he also says, and if it was disclosed to the defense, then my trial counsel's ineffective. So that shows me that there was no review of the discovery to determine whether or not it, in fact, was disclosed to the defense. The court has no other further questions. I'd ask that the trial court's order be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, I think you have about a minute left.
I'd like to first address this notion that raising an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim in the alternative somehow undermines the merits of Mr. Pham's Brady violation claim. I don't believe that it does any such thing. The reason in the way that the IAC of trial counsel claim is raised is that if this evidence was in fact discoverable in the due course, then that constituted an ineffective assistance of counsel. It's not a refutation of his claims under the Brady claim that this information was improperly withheld. What he's saying is it was improperly withheld, but if somehow it could have been discovered through the exercise of diligence, then that failure to discover it independently was ineffective assistance of counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. And the case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.